cabinet. This is class 3 with a title of The King Himself is Served by the Field. Brother Mark.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. And if I can make this, that's better. Good. Well, this morning we're going to pore over some rather obscure and fascinating details of Solomon's reign. Did you know that the son of Abinadab was Solomon's officer over the region of Dor, and that he was Solomon's son-in-law? Did you know that Zabad was the principal officer and the king's friend? No? Well, you've really been missing out. So we're going to look at some of the rather obscure details this morning of Solomon's people that he gathered around himself. Now, of course, we know that the life of Solomon is a pattern of the glorious reign of the Lord Jesus Christ that's going to be established on earth. So this morning, as we observe some of the things that actually made Solomon's empire function, and we're particularly going to look at the role of Solomon and his cabinet, the group of people that he gathered together around himself. Now, I'm not sure how familiar you are with the term cabinet. I discovered when I was talking to the teens this morning that they thought it was a wooden thing that sat in the dining room with doors on it and drawers. But we're using the word cabinet in the Westminster Parliament sense, and that is you've got ministers of the crown who form a cabinet together with the ruler himself. Okay, and as we do so, we're going to find it provides us a remarkable insight into what is required for the functioning of a kingdom. Affairs of state are weighty, and without them being properly performed, a state is doomed. So behind every successful empire sits a well-oiled machine, and that's what we're going to look at together this morning. So we're going to look first of all at the general structure which Solomon put in place overall, and then we're going to do what the record does. It narrows down to just one particular area and provides more detail on that one particular piece of the total picture. Actually, it's the logistical support in terms of food and fodder. I don't know if you've ever heard the expression, an army marches on its stomach. Well, if you don't feed your civil service, your government's not going to last long. And that's what the record does in 1 Kings chapter 4. Now, when Solomon becomes king, we know that his father's health was rapidly failing. It wasn't long before Solomon died. We've looked at the fact that Solomon was very young. David's comment was that Solomon, my son, is young and tender in 1 Chronicles 29 and verse 1. We know that Solomon himself, when he prayed asking for God's help, said in 1 Kings 3 verse 7, I am but a little child. That's how he saw himself. Now, we don't know exactly how old Solomon was. Our Jewish commentators suggest between 12 and 15. Josephus suggests that he was 14. Others suggest it was his late teens or possibly his early 20s. So we don't know. I suspect it was probably in his late teens. All we do know is that he was actually a very young man to take on that responsibility of ruling God's people, Israel. We know that he also came to the throne in a time of great danger. So Solomon knew that he needed help as a young man running this extensive kingdom. And he knew what he needed to do to get it. And so he set up a council of men who were going to work with him in the running of that kingdom. Now, why did he do it? Well, let's have the great man speak for himself. Because Solomon tells us exactly why he set up that council. And once again, we can go to the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, and they become a rich vein for us to tap into, because it tells us the principles upon which he established and ran his kingdom. The expression we used the other day is that it's the almanac, as it were, of his reign. So in Proverbs 15, verse 22, he says, without counsel, purposes are disappointed, but in the multitude of counselors, they are established. The ESV says, without counsel, plans fail, but with many advisers, they succeed. You know, brothers and sisters, there's tremendous wisdom in those simple words. In ecclesial life and in our own personal life, we neglect that simple principle at our absolute peril. Seek wisdom and input from other people when we make important decisions in life, and our decisions will be the better for it. You're probably like myself. I've sat in a number of meetings over the years in ecclesial life. It might be a ranging brethren meeting, it might be a CYC meeting, it might be a Bible class committee meeting, it might just be a general ecclesial meeting. You hear other brothers or sisters make an observation and you think, I never thought of that. And they broaden our perspective. We suddenly see things from a different perspective or with other elements that we had never considered before. Are you wiser than Solomon? Are we more clever? Perhaps more intelligent than Solomon? It's not a contest I would like to enter. Well, Solomon himself said that he needed counselors. That's his perspective. So if the wisest man that ever lived, with the exception obviously of the work of Christ, if the most wise man had that perspective, then how much more should we take advantage of those words of wisdom? In fact, he says it on a number of occasions. Proverbs 11, verse 14, where no counselors, the people fall, but in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. The ESV again, when there is no guidance, a people falls, but in an abundance of counselors, there's safety. Now, notice the different focus here. Now, his concern is on the people. Solomon always, and particularly in these early years of his reign, he portrayed a vivid concern, a very vibrant concern for the well-being of his people. It was very close to his heart. He's the one who said in 1 Chronicles 1, verses 9 and 10, to God, thou hast made me a king over a people like the dust of the earth in multitude. Who can judge this thy people that is so great? And he was overwhelmed by the burden of responsibility of having to be the leader of God's people. And here he says, where no counselors, the people fall. But in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. So he got together a group of counselors. In the abundance of counselors, the safety. So he put together an abundance of counselors to help him in the running and the administration of his kingdom. We need to have respect for the advice that brothers and sisters can give us in ecclesial life. Seek it out and have the humility to understand that they can enrich our perspective and our insight and our understanding of the things that we face. And if we ever end up in times of conflict or distress or danger, it becomes even more imperative. Proverbs 24, verse 6, for by wise counsel shalt thou make war. In the multitude of counselors there is safety. So if we put those three passages together, what do we get? Plans that succeed. A people who are kept safe and preservation in times of danger. That's Solomon's own perspective on this topic. And he knew that he needed that, even though he was the wisest man on the earth in those days. So that's precisely what he did. So I'd like you to come with me now to 1 Kings chapter 4, and we're going to meet Solomon's counselors, his cabinet that he put together. 1 Kings and chapter 4. We're going to pick up the record right at the beginning, right at the beginning of the chapter. Verse 1, so King Solomon was king over all Israel, and these were the princes which he had. Azariah the son of Zadok the priest, Elihoreph and Ahiah the sons of Shisha were the scribes, Jehoshaphat the son of Ahilud was the recorder, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada was over the host, Zadok and Abiathar were the priests, Azariah the son of Nathan was over the officers, Zabad the son of Nathan was principal officer and the king's friend, and Ahisha was over the household, and Adoniram the son of Abdar was over the tribute. So this is King Solomon's cabinet. The word princes is used to describe them in verse 2. These were the princes which he had. So they're all princes. It's the Hebrew word sar, S-A-R. Has the idea of a ruler, a chieftain, or a captive. It comes from the verb sara, which means literally to rule. So these are the men who sat down and ruled the kingdom together with Solomon. You know, we find we have to be quite careful with the various titles or the roles and the way the words are used. You're going to see that as we go through, because often the context determines what the word means. So this word tsar or princes gets used in times of scripture of religious rulers, sometimes of military rulers, sometimes of royal rulers, and sometimes of officials. So the theological word book says, very helpfully, only the context tells. So what it means is we have to look at it and say, yep, this simply means these are the people who ruled together with Solomon. Now let's note very carefully what happens in the chapter. Because in verses 2 to 6, we have this cabinet described, Solomon's inner council. And then in verse 7, the record narrows its focus down to one particular area. So in verse 5, we're introduced to Azariah, the son of Nathan, who was over the officers. And then when we get to verse 7, the record now turns to look at the group of people who reported to Azariah. These are the officers. Verse 7, Solomon had 12 officers over all Israel, which provided victuals for the king and for his household. Each man, his month, in a year, made provision. And then it tracks on down through the rest of the record through till about verse 19, describing these 12 men. Each man has a verse dedicated to himself. So that's the flow of the record, and that's what we're going to follow precisely. We're going to look at the overview first, and then we're going to look at one particular subset, which is the officers over these 12 men. Okay, let's go back to the princes. This word tsar, you know, there's a very helpful passage, we won't turn it up, but there's a very helpful passage which tells us the attributes that a man needed to be an appropriate person to be a tsar. It's in Exodus chapter 18 and verse 21, when Moses was told to put together people that ruled over the nation for him. And he was told to select, and listen to these words, able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be their rulers, and that's the word tsar, and then it comes up four times. Rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, rulers of tens. So those are the attributes of those who are fitted to be rulers in this kingdom. Capable men. They have to have a reverential fear of God. They're upright men, men of truth, and they hate covetousness. They're not distracted by the lusts of the things that this world can offer us. And those are characteristics of these men who Solomon appointed. Now let's just put up, that is Solomon's cabinet. There's actually 12 different roles mentioned here. Starting at the top, you'll notice there's two priests here, there's two scribes, and one chap, Zabad, actually holds two roles. He is both the chamberlain, and a separate phrase, he was described as the king's friend, and we'll see shortly that that's a different role. So if you go through and look at those in total, you find that there's actually 12 roles here that are described, although there were actually 11 men who held those 12 roles. So far, so good. Unfortunately, now when we start to look at the detail, it becomes a little more complicated. So we're going to work through some of the technicalities here because it's important for us to get it as clear as we can. And the first thing to notice is that the word Kohen is used in relation to four different people. Azariah, the Kohen. Zadok and Abiathar, the Kohen. Zabad, the Kohen. The word Kohen is the word that's used all through the Old Testament for priest. You could probably say in 99% of times it does mean priest. But there are occasions where the word Kohen has a meaning other than just being a priest. And I'll give you a proof of that. In 2 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 18, David's sons are described as being princes, and it uses the word Kohen. David's sons were Kohen. Later, in the equivalent passage in the book of Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 18 verse 17, David's sons are being described literally, and you'll see it in the margin, as being the first ones at the king's hand. So that's a good explanation of what the Kohen means in that particular context. And I tend to think that's the way this word Kohen is used here, because there are several men with different roles of whom the word Kohen is applied. Now, not surprisingly, I'd suggest that when we're talking about Zadok and Abiathar, it's referring to the idea of being priests. but with some of the other roles, I suspect it's being used in that wider sense of being a ruler, someone at the hand of David, to assist him in life. It's interesting. If you don't do that, then you go into all sorts of contortions, as some of the commentators do, trying to work out that all of these people were different priests. Some of them even try and say, well, the word means the high priest. And then they get into all sorts of a tangle. And then to justify that, they go back and they say, well, David's sons are called Cohen, so it means priest. So, oh, that means that the royal family took the prerogative to take over the priesthood. Well, that's just crazy. So this word Cohen does normally mean priest, but not always. And here I think it's used in a broader context as well. Okay, so who's the first one? Azariah. Now, Azariah is described here in verse 2 as being the son of Zadok the priest. Careful, the word son is the word ben, which can also mean grandson. And that's exactly what we have here. Because we're also told in 1 Chronicles 6, verse 8 and 9, that Zadok begat Ahimaaz, and Ahimaaz begat Azariah. So Azariah was actually the son of Ahimaaz. Now we know Ahimaaz. He was the runner for David. You may recall that he and Jonathan, Abiathar's sons, they were the two runners that were sent by Hushai out to bear the news and a message to David in the days of the revolt of Absalom. Ahimaaz is also the young man who wanted to run and tell David of Absalom's death. And David called him a good man in that incident in 2 Samuel 18 and verse 27. But the remarkable thing is that he doesn't appear here in the list. His dad, Zadok, does. His son, Ahaziah, does. But he himself is actually, sorry, Azariah does, but he himself is actually missing from the record. I'm pleased to say, brothers, that after careful consideration of the text, I've come to the conclusion that it appears that being a good runner is not a necessary criteria for having a function in the ecclesia. It is, however, one of the mysteries of the record that Ahimaaz has disappeared. I've got a suggestion. If you're interested in that, come and see us later. Okay, so we have this man, Azariah. His role is described as being a Cohen, and the suggestion is made that it probably just means he's a ruler, and because he's the very first one mentioned in this list, the suggestion is that he was like Solomon's prime minister, the prime minister of state there alongside King Solomon. Now that, of course, then throws up another immediately interesting question. When was this list written, and when did this particular council apply? What time in Solomon's reign? Now, the list's clearly been written after the event. Following on from Brother Bernard's talk last night, it's been compiled into the record, obviously under divine inspiration, and it's saying this is the cabinet that was there in Solomon's days. Now, I'd suggest that it's not right at the start of Solomon's reign. And that's because if he's Zadok's grandson, then when Solomon assumed the throne, as a young man, this man here, Azariah, was probably an infant. There's another reason I also think that, and that is that later on in the list, some of these officers are married to Solomon's daughters. That'd be a bit hard if Solomon was in his teens at the time. So the suggestion is that this is a bit later in his reign, I don't know, maybe 10 years in, when he's at the zenith of his power. It can't be too late in his reign, because we have references to both Zadok and Abiathar, who already, by this stage, were older men. So it probably is an indication that this list here applied at the time of the zenith of Solomon's reign. The next ones we come across are described in verse 3 as being Elihoreph and Ahiah, who were the scribes. So these are the men who act as secretaries of state. They write down the royal edicts that come from the king, and it's their job to pass those edicts on. The word scribe is the word kafar, and it means to count or to recount, rehearse or relate. So they went out with the edict of the king and they broadcast to others the edicts of the king. In Hezekiah's day, it was the role that was held by Shaphan the scribe, 2 Kings 18 and verse 18. Now just note carefully here, to be the king's scribe differed from the concept of a general scribe. A general scribe's role was to write out and to read the law of God. A king's scribe was to record and to put forth the edicts of the king himself. What we find is that by Solomon's day, that role had become sufficiently important that it was actually split with two different men. Sorry, I'm in the wrong place here. That's them here. Two different men who held that particular role of being the scribes. Okay, in verse 3, we have Jehoshaphat, who's described as the son of Ahilud. Now, I'd just like you to remember that name. File it away. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud. He's the recorder. The word recorder means the zakar, Z-A-K-A-R. It means to cause, to remember, or to call to mind. So this is the man who faithfully wrote down all the history and the record, the chronicles of the kingdom. Do you remember in the days of Ahasuerus, the king couldn't sleep? So he asked for the book of the records or the book of the chronicles of the kingdom to be brought to him so he could read through them. Well, the book of the chronicles, it's exactly the same word here, zakar. It's the recording of what takes place in the kingdom. So that's Jehoshaphat's role. So he's obviously an observant man. He's a faithful recorder of the things that have taken place. Nothing is missed. All is recorded in the book of life. Then we come across down here, Benaiah, who's described as being over the host. Of course, he had been one of David's mighty men. He had then been the personal head of David's personal bodyguard. And when Joab was dispatched, he was then moved across to take over responsibility for the armed forces as a whole. All right? Verse 4, we also have a reference to Zadok and Abiathar, who are described as the priests. Not surprisingly, I think here the word Cohen literally does mean priests, but doesn't that give us a few challenges? So remember, Abiathar was thrust out of the priesthood very early on in Solomon's reign due to the rebellion of Adonijah. Does this word Cohen refer then to the high priest's role? Well, if that's the case, then it can't be at the same time because you couldn't have both of them being high priest. So then you say, well, perhaps it's sequential, one after the other. Well, that's a possibility, but none of the other roles appear to be sequential. So some commentators suggest it's the fact that whilst Abiathar could be replaced formally, the role of the high priest was actually hereditary, and there's significance in the law of Moses of the high priest staying alive and things happening on the death of the high priest. So there's some way in which he was still related technically to the role of high priest. That's a possibility. The other option, based on 1 Chronicles 24, verses 1 to 6, they were actually the heads of the two households of the priests. So you had the total group of priests, and then there were the sons of Ithamar and the sons of Eleazar, and there were courses of the priests, the 24 courses, and they were broken into those two houses. Zadok was the head of one of those houses, and Abiathar was the head of the other. Then we come across this man here, who is, I've lost him, Azariah. Note here, a different Azariah, different father. There's another Azariah, and his role is described as being over the officers. And the word officers, natsab, means to be stationed or appointed. It's a deputy or a prefect. So he ruled over that particular group of 12 men who we're going to meet soon, and they were responsible for provisioning the king's entire establishment and government. And then we come across Zabud, who's described as being both the chamberlain and the king's friend. The phrase principal officer is what you read there in the authorized version. Zabud the son of Nathan was principal officer. The suggestion is that he was the chamberlain, so he was the king's trusted personal servant. And the next phrase saying that he was the king's friend would seem to bear that out. Excuse me. Actually, the role of the king's friend, it sounds a bit odd, but it was actually an official title. Hushai occupied that role in the days of King David. You might note 1 Chronicles chapter 27 and verse 33. There's three occasions when Hushai is described as being the king's friend or the king's companion. So this is a person who is responsible for caring for the king. The word friend there, it's an interesting word. It's the Hebrew word Reah, R-E-E-A-H. Can anybody guess what that's been derived from? R-A-A-H means to shepherd, to tend or care for a flock. And that's what the words derive from. So the implications are, this is someone whose job was to look after the king, to preserve him, to care for him, to tend him as a shepherd would, to make sure that the king was able to function fully. And then in verse 6, we meet this chap called, and I've lost him here, Ahisha, and he's described as being over the household. The NIV says the palace administrator, or the ESV says in charge of the palace. So he's the king's steward. He's responsible for the administration of the vast establishment of the king's own household. That's the role that was occupied by Eliakim in the days of King Hezekiah. In fact, it's interesting, three of those roles are there. The role of the recorder, the scribe, and being over the household. Those are the three roles that Hezekiah sent out to meet Rabshakeh when he came down. So those roles obviously carried on down through history, and they became an established part of the administration of the court. And then our last fellow we meet is a chap called Adoniram, and he's described as being over the tribute. Now that's actually a very interesting role. We're going to meet this role in one of our subsequent studies, God willing. Now, when you see the phrase over the tribute, what springs to mind? Money? It was anything but. It's actually the Hebrew word mac, M-A-C, sometimes spelt mass, M-A-S. You know what it literally means? A gang of forced laborers. The tribute here was compulsory conscription as a laborer for the king. That's actually what the tribute was, which they took. The word tribute is the word mac. It has particular meaning, literally a gang of forced labourers. In the Theological Word Book says the institution of tribute or corvée involves involuntary unpaid labour or other service for imperial power, a feudal lord, a king or foreign ruler. During Solomon's reign, mass was extended to include Israelites as well as foreigners. Now this is a major role. He actually had an entire government department under him. This man was responsible for the massive building works that characterized Solomon's reign. Not just the house of God or Solomon's own house, but a whole succession of cities, and we're going to meet some of those in a subsequent study. So these men collectively form the cabinet or the inner circle of advisors. They're remarkable men, and they shared the stage in the most glorious epoch of God's kingdom has yet been on earth. Just out of interest, note that those lower four, and I've put them on the screen for this particular reason, each one of them had a whole, and I'll use the word, government department that they were responsible for, that they administered in the affairs of state. Now the interesting thing is, this concept of having this cabinet was not actually Solomon's invention. Because his father David had run a very similar structure, but there were some notable differences between the two. Now, we don't have time to go through them, unfortunately, because we are going to run out of time, unfortunately, this morning. But David's counsel is actually listed in three separate passages. It comes up in 2 Samuel 8 in verse 15. It comes up again a number of years later in 2 Samuel 20 and verse 23. And it comes up again in 1 Chronicles 18 and verse 14. Now, we haven't got time to go through every one of those three lists. But as you start comparing them together, some very interesting things start to emerge from the record. It's quite interesting to compare the earlier and later lists in David's own reign. And then if we compare David's list and King Solomon's lists, a few things start to emerge. First of all, and this surprised me initially, none of the lists include Nathan, the prophet. I suspect that's because, as God's voice piece, he was independent of the political structures that were used to rule the kingdom. And he would come in, deliver God's message, and leave. So Nathan didn't form part of this particular cabinet. A man called Adoniram is not in David's first list, but he does appear in David's second list. And that's because Adoniram, and we meet him again here, was over the tribute, or the forced levy. Now, why is that? Well, that's because right at the end of David's days, he decides he wants to get everything prepared for Solomon to build the cabinet. So he appoints Adoniram to start the process of getting laborers out of the nation to go and hew the trees, cut the trees and hew the stones, and get everything ready for the building of the house. And so he appointed a new role, which was this man, Adoniram, who took that particular responsibility right at the end of David's reign. In fact, some commentators suggest that that might be what was behind David's numbering of Israel. That it wasn't just for military purposes, but what they actually did was they started taking a levy of the people in Israel in those days, of the able-bodied men that they could use for the labouring. It's also interesting to know that in David's first list, his sons appear. By the second list in David's life, they're gone. And in fact, we find that there's a man called, and I've lost it in my notes here somewhere, but it's there somewhere, that, Ira, the Jerite, had actually taken over the role that was attributed to them in that first list. Rather sad reflection of the fact there that probably they'd proved themselves unworthy. And by the end of his reign, he no longer had those sons, those particular sons, in his inner cabinet. You know, there's another very interesting little feature. We will turn up one of those lists. Keep a finger here in 1 Kings 4, because we're going to come back to it. And let's go across to 2 Samuel chapter 8. Now, this is the first of the lists in David's life. And I'd just like you to note something. 2 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 15. David reigned over all Israel. David executed judgment and justice unto all his people. And Joab the son of Zeruiah was over the host. Jehoshaphat the son of Ahilud was recorder. Zadok the son of Ahitub and Ahimelech the son of Abiathar were the priests. Seraiah was the scribe. Benaiah the son of Jehoiada was over both the Kerethites and the Pelethites. And David's sons were the chief rulers. Okay, who's the very first person listed in David's cabinet? Joab, the head of the army. And every single list that we have of David's cabinet puts the head of the armed forces there first. Did you notice Benaiah as being over the Kerethites and the Pelethites? That was David's personal bodyguard. So two of his cabinet were military men, one over his personal bodyguard and the other over the armed forces. And we find that with all the records of David's cabinet. It's interesting, isn't it? That actually the man of war was right at the start of David's cabinet. And in fact, this becomes an overwhelming difference between the two governments. In Solomon's day, we've already noted that there were 12 officers over the land, and they had a responsibility every month to bring forward what? A provision of food. Well, David had 12 officers, and they were over the land, and they brought something forward every month. What? 24,000 men as a standing army, and that rotated around the nation. And you can see these contrasts being painted between the reign of David and the reign of Solomon. Now, remember what God said to David? You can't build my house because you have been a man of war. And these things make that very obvious. But your son, King Solomon, will be a man of peace and rest. And we see that reflected. In his day, there's no longer two roles. He's combined the role of the bodyguard and the armed forces into one, and it's Benaiah. And it doesn't appear at the forefront of the list of people that are in his inner cabinet. So you start to see the different flavours that are there between these two particular lists. In addition to this, by the way, both men had structures below this as well. They had the heads of the tribes. There's a record that talks about David having a group of people who looked after his possessions. One chap looked after the camels and another after the sheep, and other people looked after his vineyards, and so on. And so there were other administrative structures, but this was the inner cabinet itself. Now, whilst we've got these lists here, I'd like us to note something very wonderful that starts to come out. First of all, we're currently in 2 Samuel and chapter 9. Who is the recorder there described in verse 16? Jehoshaphat? the son of Ahilud. So who's the recorder in the days of King Solomon? 1 Kings 4, and what have we got? Verse 3, Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder. It's exactly the same man. Okay, who was the captain of David's bodyguard? Benaiah. Who's the head of Solomon's armed forces? Why? Benaiah. Who were the priests in David's day? And we find that both Zadok and Abiathar in one of the records particularly are very prominent. Well, they're exactly the same two people that are there in the days of King Solomon. Who was over the tribute? Adoniram. It's exactly the same man. And we find that again. He has exactly the same name. Sometimes, by the way, he's called Adoram in the record. Sometimes Adoniram, same name, just abbreviated slightly. So what do we have? We've got Solomon valuing the wisdom and the expertise of men who had served his father's well. So there's a whole lot of people here who were in his father's cabinet who are in his cabinet as well. Now, is that accidental? Well, who wrote these words? Thine own friend and thy father's friend forsake not. Proverbs 27 and verse 10. So we can see how he valued faithful men who were friends of his father. Now, whilst we're there, look at this. Solomon had two scribes, Elihoreph and Ahiah. And they're described in 1 Kings chapter 4 as being the sons of Shisha. And we find from the record that Shisha actually became David's scribe. We note that they've gone from one to two because it was a more complex role, but they carried on in exactly the same role that their father had had. So who's Solomon's prime minister? Azariah, the grandson of one of David's close friends, Zadok. Who were Solomon's cabinet members over the officers? Here's a man who is over the officers down here, Azariah. And who was Zabud, who's described as the principal officer and the king's friend? Well, they're both the sons of Nathan, probably Nathan the prophet. We also note that actually some of Solomon's officers over the land, described in chapter 4 and verse 16, are described as being the sons of Hushai, who was a personal friend of David's. And the recorder was Jehoshaphat, as we've said, but his brother, in verse 12, another son of Ahilud, was one of Solomon's officers. So what do we have here, brothers and sisters? An intergenerational commitment to the work of the truth in that nation. Extraordinary. This is now passing down through the generations. And in fact, with this fellow up here, he's the grandson of Zadok. So now we have a commitment of faithful service which lasts down through the generations. Also, in that list of names in 1 Kings chapter 4, there are no fewer than at least three sets of brothers there. So now this is not just the truth going from father to son, or the service going from father to son, but now we've got brothers in the same family who are working faithfully side by side. You know what that tells us, brothers and sisters? It tells us this, that if we establish strong values in our families, they last the distance. And if faithful brothers and sisters teach their children the same spirit of commitment to the truth, it continues on into the next generation and the next generation again. It's a very powerful message for us, brothers and sisters, that if we are wholeheartedly committed to the work of the truth ourselves as husbands and wives, and then we teach those principles of commitment to our children, they carry on. And isn't it marvellous to see brothers working together in these roles? And the other thing that stands out is there's a series of different families there. And those families keep working together generation after generation. That provides wisdom and strength in our ecclesial environment. So there's a very powerful message for you and for me, brothers and sisters, with our families and with our children, to try and teach them the principles of commitment to the things of ecclesial life, and it lasts the distance. It carries on generation to generation. And in the process, let's build friendships with other brothers and sisters who share those same values and commitments. Because families work together with families, and we see it demonstrated so clearly here in this particular record. So build those friendships, very deliberately, build those friendships with families who share the same love and commitment for the truth. And actually, we need to invest in it. It's something worth protecting and nourishing. And then we need to teach our children to value that as well, because then it will last and it will carry on in that work. If we speak to our children with respect about other families and what they contribute to ecclesial life, surprise, surprise, our children will respect those families. If we speak to our children with disrespect or with mocking about other families and their foibles and their attributes, then don't expect our children to work faithfully together in the service of the truth. So this is something, brothers and sisters, which we need to nourish and protect. And this is a splendid example of the way in which faithful families, generation after generation, were there in the governance and the administration of that land. It works and it lasts the distance. It's something we need to treasure and protect. All right, well, that's the inner cabinet by way of overview of the specific roles. What we're going to do now is follow the flow of Scripture, and it takes us down to look at one particular area, which is this area here. We had Azariah, who's described as being over these offices or these provisioning offices. Now, these 12 men, each man has a verse dedicated to him, run through from verse 8 through to verse 19. So verse 7 again for context, Solomon had 12 officers over all Israel. They provided food or victuals for the king and his household. Each man his month in a year made provision. And these are their names. The son of Hur in Mount Ephraim, the son of Dekar in Markaz, and so forth, right through until we get to verse 19. Geba the son of Uri was in the country of Gilead, in the country of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and of Og, king of Bashan, and he was the only officer which was in the land. So we have these 12 men. So a few quite interesting things. A couple of them married Solomon's daughters. So clearly these were well-respected roles, and these were very faithful people. So two of them married Solomon's daughters. Five of them, and I have no reason, I don't have an answer as to why, so I'd be really interested if anyone can come up with an answer. Five of them are only known by the patronymic. In other words, by their father's name. Let's have a look. Look at verse 8. These are their names. The son of Hur in Mount Ephraim. Well, who was he? Not told. Verse 9, the son of Dekar in Markaz. Verse 10, the son of Hesed. Now, they're not all that's known by their father's names. Some of them have their own name there. But five of them are known only by their father's names. I suspect that it means that there's something in the meaning of the various names which is significant. But by the time you list 12 of them and the meaning of the names, you could just about write the Encyclopedia Britannica in terms of trying to come up with a meaning. So there's more work to be done here, trying to work out why it is that some of these men are only known by their father's name. Obviously, the record is pointing us to their father for some particular reason that so far has escaped me. But they're prominent men. The record tells us that each man had 1 month. End of verse 7, each man, his month in a year, made provision. When it says 1 month, literally it means in the new moon. So you know how when there was a new moon in Israel, there was a lot of things took place. There were special burnt offerings offered by the king. There was the blowing of trumpets and various things associated with feasts. But when the new moon came in and the new month started, it was also the time when responsibility for provisioning moved from one of these men to another of these 12 officers. There's much that we don't know about it. I don't know whether it was done on a percentage basis or whether each region had exactly 1/12. But what we do know is that when the responsibility was yours, and you were the officer responsible for that region, and it came round to your month, you had to provide the food or the provisioning for Solomon's household for that month. So what that meant was that in the rest of the year, you're gathering up produce and you're putting it into a store so that when the month comes of your responsibility, you've got food that you can take to support the king and his systems. Can you imagine the land bustling with transport? Can you imagine the network and the infrastructure that was responsible for moving this vast amount of produce around the land as each of these regions in time took on their own personal responsibility? Now note carefully, this system is quite distinct from the structures set up under the Mosaic Law. Under the Mosaic Law, they had a whole tithing system that was put in place. This is quite different. This is for the support of the king. And the role of the king is not talked about much in the law. In Genesis 49, we've got a monarchy predicted. Deuteronomy 17, the king has to write out the book of the law. But there's not a lot written about the monarchy and the way the monarchy was administered. Samuel warned them about the tithes that a king would levy on them. And what we have here is a whole system to support the king and his household. Now, we don't have time to go through them in great detail, but what you can do, and I've got them actually in the exact order which they come up as you go through the record. And you can go through region by region. That's the first region down here. And thankfully, as you go through and read the names, you can actually still identify on the maps of Israel in those days where some of the places are. Enough to be able to actually work out where each of the general regions were. And I'm not going to go through verse by verse, but this goes through verse 8, verse 9, verse 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19. You'll notice that last one is a little bit unusual. We'll talk about that now. Area 12 is a bit strange. It seems to run right over the top of two of these other areas here. Now we get that confirmed because it describes it as being, notice the description there in verse 19, the country of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan. Well, Og was up to the north, the area of Bashan, and his city was Edrei. Sihon was down to the south, and his city was Heshbon. So you can't avoid the conclusion that that's an enormous territory, and it overlaps two subsets which sit within it. Now, why is that? Well, note the phrase in verse 19. At the end there, it says, he was the only officer which was in the land. His name, by the way, is Gibor, which is the same as Gibor. He's a mighty man. He's the only officer that was in the land. The word land there is Eretz. It can mean the whole land of Israel, or it can be used to refer to just a particular region. And the suggestion is that he was the man who was responsible for the entire eastern coast of Israel, all the land on the other side of the Jordan. One of the interesting things is he also ruled over Area 6, and Area 6 is recorded in verse 13 as being looked after by the son of Geba. So it would appear that actually one of his sons looked after a subset, and this man looked over after that whole area on the east there. Another interesting observation, some of them are referred to as being areas of tribes, but most of them are not. So it would seem, and some of the boundaries of these different regions actually cut over multiple tribes. So this is not a tribal differentiation. It seems that it's actually regional, and it would appear that it's based on fertile areas of the land with different climates, different eco-climates, and different produce from particular areas of the land. So it's been divided on a different basis from your traditional tribal groupings. You know something else that's really interesting? Can anyone spot on that map the area that's not covered? Judah. That's Judah down here. And Judah is not covered. We're not told why, it would appear for some reason that they were exempted. One wonders if it's because it was the king's own tribe. If we think through the latter application of this, there's an interesting principle at work. Remember the words of the Lord Jesus Christ? What thinkest thou, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute? Of their own children or strangers? Peter said to him, of strangers. Jesus saith unto him, then are the children free. And I wonder if that principle is being established here in the fact that Judah was exempt. And I wonder if that becomes an interesting little application in terms of the future age when the kingdom of Christ is established and Israel will be exempted from the taxes. Anyway, just a little sidetrack. There's a few interesting little quirks here in the way in which these regions are put together. But what I want us to focus on in our remaining time is, why was this needed? Why this enormous infrastructure and all this complexity of 12 different offices ruling over these 12 different regions? Why was all that needed? Well, let's have a look at verse 22. Solomon's provision for one day. Solomon was obviously a very hungry chap. Solomon's provision for one day was 30 measures of fine flour, 70 measures of meal, 10 fat oxen, 20 oxen out of the pastures, 100 sheep, besides hart and roebucks and fallow deer and fatted fowl. Now that is quite a meal list for every single day. That's Solomon's provision for one day. When it says there fine flour, it's the Hebrew word koleth, C-O-L-E-T-H. And it refers to flour that's been made exclusively from the inner kernel of the wheat. So the outer husk has been removed, the outer kernel's been removed, and the innermost part of the wheat only is used to make this fine flour. The theological word book says, though available to all, which of course it would be, it was expensive and considered a luxury item to be used especially in entertaining important guests. And that's contrasted with the meal, which is also there. So you've got 30 measures of fine flour and 70 measures of meal, which is the ordinary wheat, not just the fine inner part of the inner kernel. Now, the word measure here is the Hebrew word kor, C-O-R, and that means 220 litres. So that's 6,600 litres of fine flour, 13,200 litres of meal. That's 20 tons of wheat per day. Now, that's huge. Interestingly, by the way, it might be huge, but it's not impossible. There are records of some of the ancient Persian Persian courts, and their daily food manifest was actually a little bit higher than what's being described here. Calculation is that this would have supported something like 14,000 people. The estimates vary between 3,000 to 50,000. But it seems about 14,000 people per day were fed by this daily provision. Now, that's because it wasn't just for the palace. This actually wasn't just Solomon and his 1,000 wives. This actually fed Solomon's entire court and his servants and their administration throughout the land. Now, we know that because in verse 27 and 28, it tells us again about these officers. Those officers provided victual for King Solomon and for all that came unto King Solomon's table, every man in his month, they lacked nothing. Barley also and straw for the horses and dromedaries brought they unto the place where they were, every man according to his charge. What that means is there's provisioning not just for people, but also for the animals. And it's wherever they are. It's wherever they're located. So he had his chariot cities. He had his soldiers and his horsemen. He had his administrative officials throughout the entire land. And this food budget was to feed his civil service on a daily basis. So again, just imagine the infrastructure that was necessary to move this sort of produce through the land and from the storehouses on a daily basis. You know, it just conveys to us the impression that this wasn't some little primitive medieval village clinging on the face of a cliff somewhere. This is an empire. It's got an administrative structure that runs through the land. There's people in different roles, and there's a huge infrastructure of transport there, providing the food and the provisions for each person according to their need day by day. Again, it just makes us stop and think, you know, I wonder what it's going to be like in the kingdom. Will the Lord Jesus Christ have a whole infrastructure of management? And the answer is, of course. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Be thou the ruler over 10 cities, 5 cities. There's going to be a global management structure put in place by the Lord Jesus Christ. And the meticulous details here are showing us that. But there will be people here who are then associated with the work. Actually, it reminds us of a passage which I have skipped over somewhere in my notes. Let me see if I can find it, because I think it's actually worth going back and having a look at if I can find it. If I can't, I'm just going to have to quote it from memory. But it's the passage where the Lord's speaking to the disciples, and he says to them, in fact, maybe it's still coming in my notes. It is. Come with me to Luke 22. We'll go and look at it now. It's worth looking at. Luke 22. I mean, this just shows us that actually the Lord Jesus Christ will have a very similar structure in place. You know, these historical details back in 1 Kings chapter 4 aren't written there merely to give us some sort of technical understanding of what happened in Solomon's day. Luke chapter 22, and let's pick up the record in verse 28. This is Christ speaking to his disciples. Ye are they which have continued with me in my temptations. And I appoint unto you a kingdom as my Father hath appointed unto me. And note this, that ye may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So here he is telling his disciples that they will have specific roles, that they will sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel, and particularly that they will eat and drink at his table. This is the antitype of what we see sitting back in 1 Kings chapter 4. That as we see Solomon putting in place all these administrative structures and these people that ate at his table, so it's telling us that the Lord Jesus Christ is going to have in place an administrative structure that enables him to manage the kingdom when it is actually set up. God willing, brothers and sisters, we hope to have a part and a role to play in that particular infrastructure in the time to come. Let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 4. You know, you ask the question, well, why out of all the roles which are described in Solomon's cabinet, does it dive down into that level of additional detail simply to describe the food? Well, the food becomes quite prominent in this chapter. We've got the description of all these 12 men and what they had to do. Verse 20, Judah and Israel were as many as the sand which is by the seaside multitude, eating and drinking and making merry. Verse 22, 23 talks about the provision of food for Solomon's court. Verse 25 talks about Judah and Israel dwelling safely, every man under his vine and his fig tree. And then it goes and talks again in verse 27 and 28 about the food that is brought for those that come to King Solomon's table. There's a very strong emphasis here on the need for food and the fact that people had food. You know, we'll look at this actually in our last study on the arrival of the Queen of Sheba. You know, one of the things that she marveled about was the food. It says she came and she saw all these things, and it lists the fact, oh, she saw Solomon's food. And she saw the sitting of his servants at the table. This is one of the things that absolutely floored her. She was amazed at Solomon's servants sitting at the table eating dinner. There's a lot of emphasis here on food in the record. Now, there's a few reasons for that. Every empire needs a strong, functioning economy. Every strong economy needs a productive base to support it. It might be mineral resources, It might be technology, it might be manufacturing, it might be agriculture. In New Zealand, it's predominantly primary produce. So forestry, fishing, things off the land, sheep, meat, those sorts of things. That's the economic base of New Zealand as a country. I don't know what it is for Canada. I guess you've got forestry, you've got a bit of oil, but whatever it is, every economy needs a productive base. Agriculture was the productive base of this economy. Now we know that because later, when Solomon builds his buildings, he needs material. And the material comes down from Tyre. He needed labour. And a lot of the labour came down from the area of Tyre. And Solomon agreed to pay for it in food. So he supplied Hiram huge shiploads of food and produce as payment for the shipment of materials and also labour. So this productive blessing that God gave them of the land, and I suspect that what actually happened was God blessed the productive base of their nation enormously in that period of time. And that's what gave Solomon's empire a lot of its strength and stability, and its ability to trade with other nations as well. A functioning economy also needs a number of things. It needs peace and stability. Well, that was provided by God, wasn't it? He shall be a man of peace. A functioning economy needs good laws. Well, they had the law of Moses to provide discipline and structure. A functioning economy needs good governance. Well, they had that with Solomon's cabinet. And in a functioning economy, you also need a basic respect for property rights. It's interesting. If you go through the theoretical dissertations you can read on what's required for a good economy, a respect of property rights is a very important part of it, because then people happily labour. Well, you know, that was a fundamental principle in Solomon's own life. The words of Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 9 are really interesting. He says, "The profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field." That's where our title came for this morning's study. Now, isn't that an interesting observation? The profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field. There's a respect for the fact that Israelites needed to have their own little plot of earth. Did you notice that little phrase that we picked up when it said, verse 25, every man under his vine and under his fig tree? You know, that is much more enlightened than medieval England. Here's each person having their own vine and their own fig tree. There's basic respect for property rights. These are fundamental things which are needed for a properly functioning economy. It was no accident. But, you know, as we start to look at this idea of food, we say, well, is there another layer here? Is there another application? And the answer is yes. We haven't got time to go through it, brothers and sisters, but just think through the whole parable of food in Scripture, of the bringing in of the harvest. Remember the Lord said, pray to the Lord that he might send labourers into his harvest. When he said to the disciples, look, the fields are white to harvest as people were coming to hear. So the harvest and the bringing in of the wheat is a glorious symbol in Scripture, the parable of gathering people in. The bringing of them then into the storehouses that Solomon built is a symbol of ecclesial life. The provision of those resources for the purposes of the king. There's an enormous parable that sits there underneath this story as well. And in that regard, I'd like to go back to 1 Kings chapter 4 and pick up two little phrases at the end of the chapter. The first one, brothers and sisters, is in verse 28. Having listed the things which they need to bring, at the end it says, every man according to his charge. It means a commandment, there's an obligation. Everybody had a responsibility to contribute to the bringing of these provisions. And the other little phrase is at the end of verse 27, every man in his month, they lacked nothing. What a beautiful symbol there, brothers and sisters, of a collective ecclesia where every person has done what they were charged to do by the great king. They've all brought their contributions, labouring as the harvest was brought together into the storehouses to support the administration of the kingdom of this great king, and they lacked nothing. May it be that in the time when the great new administrative structure of the kingdom is set up, we have the privilege and the blessing of being able to participate in that rulership on the basis that we've kept the charge and lack nothing.